Hello and welcome to Here Now TV. My name is Andy and my guest today is once again non-duality speaker Richard Sylvester. Hello Richard.
Hi there.
Hi, nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
Well, we will talk about your talks, your latest book and upcoming projects. So, for quite a long time now, you give talks on non-duality. I'm curious, has your core message changed and has the way you present your message changed throughout the years?
It's a good question. The answer to the first part of that question is absolutely not, no. The communication, I'm a bit resistant to the word message because maybe it sounds a little bit portentous, but anyway, no, that hasn't changed. The way I present it, I don't really think I know what to say there. It may have done, it may not, but in essence, what I'm saying now is still the same as what I was saying 10 years and more ago.
Okay, what would you prefer to call it, if not message, because that was the word that just came up?
Yes, I suppose the most neutral word I can think of is communication, but really, in essence, what happens in my meetings is I get together with a bunch of people and I chat, and that chat tends to start with perhaps me chatting in the form of a monologue for maybe half an hour at first, and then after that we have a give and take chat.
And you enjoy that?
Yeah, I enjoy it very much, yeah. It's really the only reason I do it, is because I enjoy it.
And after all this apparent time, you still enjoy it, even though it's always about the same in core?
Yeah, I can't explain this. I can say it and I know I mean it, which is that somehow it's always new. Uh-huh. It's always new, but I can't explain why feels like that.
Well, okay. You see, non-duality is usually seen as a subsection of spirituality. So, what can you say about this? Why do you think it ended up as a subsection of spirituality? Because I'm sure you will say it is actually not about spirituality.
Yes, I would say that. I'd say it's not about spirituality. It's not about spirituality. Non-duality embraces everything. Mm. So if we assume, and it is an assumption, that there is, let's call it, type of human experience that we could split off and call spirituality, then non-duality embraces that and includes that, just as it embraces and includes drinking tea, for example. I mean, I would probably challenge whether that term spirituality really means anything significant anyway. But you also ask, why do I think non-duality is seen in that way? I think because basically something that's called spirituality is bound to be a great deal more popular and a great deal more commercially viable than non-duality in its raw form, let's say. Can I just add, I mean, I noticed, I mean, many years ago there were meetings in, I think originally in America, in Britain also, called science and spirituality meetings. Mm-hmm. And then there came a time when they were relabeled as science and non-duality meetings. So at that point, non-duality had successfully taken over quite a lot of the field of spirituality. Although not all of it. I mean, there are a lot of, there's a lot of business operating under the term spirituality which wouldn't recognize itself necessarily as non-dual.
Yeah, but most people seem to see really or confuse non-duality with spirituality. Like they hear advice, of course, it is one, it is a also in Indian philosophy and or Western spirituality.
Well, as it's impossible to understand non-duality with the mind, it's very easy for the mind to confuse it with something else.
Oh, okay. So it seems to sounds so weird to the mind that people think, oh, of course, it's kind of a belief, a spiritual belief or so.
Yeah, it's very, very... I mean, in a way, I mean, if you challenged me about this, I might back down, but I'm going to say it for now and then see if you challenge me. In a way, you could say, well, spirituality is really, it's non-duality plus superstition of some kind or another. And it's very, very easy for superstition to come in because it's interesting, it's fascinating. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why we love superstitions.
Ah, you mean many forms of spirituality are like... embrace the idea of oneness,
yes.
But they add something
yes.
to it that is actually kind of a fantasy.
They add superstitious beliefs, and in that way you could say, well, spirituality is the same as religion. I mean, religion is in a sense simply a different word for superstition. The difference with religion is that religion is often, although not always, completely devoid of spirituality. But in a sense, you could say religion and spirituality are both equally superstitious.
Okay, but that's a really interesting quote, that actually spirituality is like non-duality with superstition. Nice. Never heard that before.
Well, I did say that if you challenge me about that, I might back down. But at the moment, you haven't challenged me, so I'm not backing down.
No, I'm not challenging you. I like new ideas. I never heard that idea. Yeah, well... let's talk about your books.
Oh, yes.
I never talked about all your books in one setting, and this is what we are going to do now.
There's so many of them. It's ridiculous.
Well, of course, we will talk mostly about your most recent book that came out. But
would you like me to show it to the camera at this point?
No, later.
When
I talk about it, actually.
Yeah.
First off, in 2006, I Hope You Die Soon came out.
Yes.
For all Germans, the German book is called Erleuchtet und was jetzt, Enlightened and what now. We already talked about that. That was not your idea to give it that title. It looks
to comment on publisher's power.
It looks much nicer and in warm colors and so on. Well, your book is a little bit darker. I just wanted to know, what inspired you from what you can remember to write I Hope You Die Soon?
Well, it was written, I would describe it, in the afterglow of, there's no good word for this, so I'm going to use the word realization. It was written in the kind of warm and ecstatic afterglow of realization. So it was written quite soon after the sense of self had fallen away here. And so there was quite a sense of excitement about it. And I think very much a desire not to intellectualize. Not to go into abstract questions too deeply and so forth, but rather just to kind of give an impression of what that falling away of the self was like, and then throw in whatever very spontaneous ideas came to me.
So, as far as I can remember, and I could be wrong here, because it is some time ago that I read it, didn't it include many talks from you?
No, it included one very short talk. No, it was mostly, it was in a way, it was almost quite aphoristic. I mean, some of the pages only had about 20 words on them. It did include a short interview and one short talk.
I'm sorry, I confused it with The Book of No One. I'm sorry, of course. Yes, I Hope You Die Soon is quite a small book.
It's a very small book, yes. I wonder sometimes whether I might get complaints, but so far I haven't, because there's quite a lot of blank page paper in it.
I find it quite cute. Also, I don't like to read that much, so I find it refreshing.
Yeah, no, I still like it. I mean, I have to say, I still like it myself very much as a book.
So, yeah, Enlightenment for the Lazy Person.
And
the title...
Well, there's nothing I can say about enlightenment other than, if it's possible, try to relax. So that sounds... I mean, that's not an instruction, by the way, but that's kind of quite appealing to the lazy person.
Yeah, you could just say relaxation might be nice.
There's no path. Well, one of the things I say is there is no path, but if there were a path, it would be relaxation.
Okay. And the title, I Hope You Die Soon, was... can you tell the story again? do a short story? Yeah, it's how a you sweet came to the story. Title?
Yes, I used to go and see Tony regularly, and when I was in a state of despair for quite a long time, and when I was really in a state of despair, I would tend to phone Tony up or talk to him before or after talks, and he was very patient with me. And one day I went up to him after a talk in a state of despair as usual, and he just gave me a very warm hug and said, "Richard, I hope you die soon." I don't think it's necessary to explain what he meant by that, you know, it's in the book.
The sense of self dropping away.
Exactly that, yeah.
And you say you phoned him up sometimes,
yeah,
in despair. What can you give an example? What kind of reason gave you to phone him up?
Well, just despair, just sort of this long, agonizing period of despair, which is, again, I need to be careful what I say because I don't want to suggest there are any rules about this, but it's fairly common for there to be a period of despair which precedes the dropping away of the self.
But what
it's not necessary, but it is reasonably common.
But despair about what? That you didn't have what Tony seemed to have?
In a way, I would say it's almost like it's not despair about anything. It is simply a sense of experience, simply a sort of, you know, phenomenologically speaking, it's just the experience of despair. But if we're going to talk about it in mind terms, yes, it would be despair about the apparent impossibility, wanting something desperately, but the impossibility of not only having it, but even knowing what it could possibly be. So it's a very, very, very bizarre place to be in, but it's very common. I mean, we have this common phrase in English, and the dark night of the soul, which I think expresses that very well. Some people write about being in the desert. You know, we have quite a few metaphors.
Is it also that you kind of feel not enough, not good enough, and you just see this person seems to be okay, yeah, with life, and you just don't get why he's okay, because life is a mess and it's tragic and it's bad, so you really just want to relax, yeah, for heaven's sake.
All of that, yeah. And of course, by then I'd had perhaps 30 years of seeking, during which I had read many books that suggested there was some kind of strange secret that I couldn't get access to. I had studied with many teachers. I had sat at the foot of gurus, all of whom seemed to be suggesting there was some kind of very, very special secret about existence that only very, very special people could have access to. And I had no way of knowing what that special secret was, in the same way that every seeker has no way of knowing what that special secret is, which is precisely, of course, what keeps us seeking.
Yeah. So, but you, I think in your latest book you wrote, you were also a trainer and for showing other people kind of a transpersonal experience or so.
Transpersonal therapy, I would say, and transpersonal psychology, yeah.
You had transpersonal experiences?
Many.
You had them before?
Many.
Dropping away of the self?
And not in the way that we're talking about it here, but at, yes, the time that those experiences happened, and they were experiences, I couldn't know that. Okay. It was only later, when the self really dropped away, that I could know that those transpersonal experiences had nothing to do with what we're talking about here.
What's the difference?
It's very, very difficult to... it's impossible to describe, but let me have a try to...
Yes, a try.
As Alan Watts says, let's try to F the ineffable.
Yes.
The only way I've ever been able to put this is that in a transpersonal experience, no matter how translucent or how evanescent it is, there is still somehow the sense of somebody there having that experience. Now, that sense may be very vague, very hazy, very misty, almost like the thinnest of veils. And yet, nevertheless, in a sense, the clue is in the term transpersonal experience. An experience is something that happens to someone. And even if that someone has become very misty and very translucent, there's still of someone there. And what we're talking about here, which is let's use the phrase, the dropping away of the self. In the dropping away of the self, there is no one there. And there is, once that has occurred, there is no possibility anymore of confusing those two events, let's say, the a transpersonal experience on the one hand and the dropping away of the self on the other hand.
Mm. Okay, so when the self drops away, it's not, oh, it happens to me, because then it wouldn't make any sense to say the self drops away if it happens to itself. But
that's why I can confidently say that the self dropping away will never happen for you, and the self dropping away has not happened for me.
So you could say it's not like someone experiences that there's only life, rather than there's I experience life and then there's only life.
Yeah, it's that difference. There's someone experiencing that there's only life, and then life there's just life happening.
Yeah,
it's exactly
and
like
even
that.
Life is still a term, which,
well, there's just absolutely, in a way we could just say there is still happening, whatever is happening. All there is phenomena. Whatever's happening, whatever experience is arising, that's all there is.
I think you said you were, as the story goes, at a train station, and then at first it was Richard at the train station, and then it was only the train station. But you said the happening was still... how could we possibly say that? Life still expressed itself as a apparent train station and wind blowing or whatever?
We could express it like that, and that was describing a momentary dropping away of the self, which is sometimes given the word awakening, not that the word matters.
Yeah.
And what happens quite often, it happened here and it quite often happens, is that there's this momentary dropping away of the self, and then immediately after that the self comes back again. But in that moment, absolutely, it is simply seen there is only life happening.
Yes.
And what is also seen is that what is happening is completely empty. It's completely empty. It's just an empty show. That's what is often reported in a split second of awakening.
Yeah, but as you...
It's almost like a hologram. It's almost like a hologram. Like everything is almost like a hologram.
Yes.
Or like a dream is a common metaphor used.
However, it is usually perceived as a world of things with separate things. Is actually not what it is. It's just what life presents itself as.
Yeah.
And
we could say that what appears to the normal eye to be three-dimensional is suddenly revealed to be two-dimensional. I mean, these are only metaphors in a way, because it is impossible to describe this, but it's just a way of trying to grasp the ungraspable.
Yes. Well, okay, we'll talk about that later again. Now we'll come back to the books.
Okay.
So, 2008, you wrote, or I think that was the year when it came out, The Book of No One, Talks and Dialogues on Non-Duality and Liberation. In German, it's called Das Buch Niemand. That means
that's
Buch
a
No
good
One.
Title.
It's a better title. And it looks like the Bible, and it's black.
It's huge, and it's, yes, absolutely.
It's nice. I like it. So, it's a story and stuff, but I really like to talk about the story. So how long did it take for you to write this book? I think much longer than I Hope You Die Soon.
Yes, much longer. I mean, in a way, it was a book that wrote itself. The writing of it, from my point of view, was really a huge editing job, because basically, I mean, this is sometimes called lazy author's writing. Basically, what I did was, the book, it's a series of transcripts of various meetings that I'd given. Excuse me, I have a glass of water here.
Of course.
So I regularly, by that stage, I was regularly giving talks in London, and I recorded those talks and then transcribed them. So it was a huge editing job.
Oh, you did it yourself, Noel?
I did it myself. Oh, yes, my God, yes. My enormous, my enormous team of pixies and elves just went on strike and refused to do the work. I had to do it myself.
Oh wow! So that must have been many talks.
I can't remember how many are in the book, but maybe about a dozen.
And you just...
It's quite fun, though, actually. You see, I mean, I like writing, so it's quite fun.
Okay.
It's not like it's work to me.
And how did you come to the title, The Book of No One?
That's an interesting question. It took a very long time to come. The title of the first book came immediately. I remember sitting in the garden of a pub with my girlfriend and another friend for about an hour over lunch one day, all coming up with titles for this book, none of which worked properly, and I was kind of in despair. And then in the end, the Book of No One came to me, and I thought, well, it will have to do. It was a sort of sense of resignation. I've got to call it something. And then it was only later that, actually, that's a pretty good title. I kind of like it.
Okay.
I mean, of my first three books, it's the only title that actually does what it says on the tin.
Yeah, nice. I like it. A few years later, 2011, the next book was Drink Tea, Eat Cake. No,
yes.
And it is not published in German, very sadly, I have to say.
It is published in German.
It
was actually published in German first.
What?
Yeah.
Oh,
it came out in German first.
Sorry about being wrong about this, yeah. Guys. I must have made a mistake there.
However, I have very tragic news, which is that the English edition is now out of print, which is very sad.
Oh, but isn't that also good news? Because all of them have sold.
No, it's very bad news because the publisher isn't issuing it anymore.
Oh, okay.
Basically, my very small English publisher got taken over by a much bigger American publisher, which in many ways is entirely beneficial. It's great, really. But unfortunately, it's to do with the... I won't bore you with it. It's to do with the licensing agreement with Germany. They don't publish it anymore.
Okay.
However, I will say to anybody who's watching this that if anybody wants a copy and they can't get hold of it, I've still got a few, so they can contact me.
Do you remember how the German title was?
No, I can't, because the German title has nothing to do with the English title.
Okay, maybe that's the reason I didn't find it. Okay, well, and anyway, Drink Tea, Eat Cake, what gave you the idea to write that book?
Like, well, it was given to me. I didn't have to think of it myself. What happened was that my German publisher, a lovely man, who had published the first two books in German, then contacted me, came over to London and met up with me and suggested that I do a book tour of Germany to publicise The Book of No One.
Oh.
And then later on, a week or two later, he contacted me again and said, hey, I've got an even better idea. When you do this book tour, why don't we record all the talks and then we can have a third book? So that's what happened. So I went round these various German cities with my publisher, and he recorded everything on a tiny, tiny little recorder that I had no confidence would actually work, but it did. And then he got, I think he may have even done it anyway, he got somebody to transcribe it all, and there was a book. And then later on, it was published in the English form.
Oh, but this time
you... So again, you see, lazy writing. I've been very, very fortunate. All the four books that I've written so far, and we'll come on to the fifth book maybe later, but they've all really been rather lazy writing. I do feel a bit of a kind of fraud almost as an author.
But this time you had help with the transcribing of the talk?
Yeah, I didn't have to transcribe any of it. Yeah, all I had to do was edit it. Yeah, he arranged for it all to be transcribed. And then, you know, the English parts of it were sent to me, and all I had to do was edit it. That's why I call it lazy writing.
And you didn't even have to translate it into English?
Well, no, because my bits were already in English.
Okay. Ah, of course, okay. And so you only had to edit it into maybe make a few suggestions what to leave out and stuff.
Yeah, I just had to turn the outpouring of the human voice never looks good on paper unless it's actually edited. So that's all I had to do to it. Yeah.
Yeah, I've read the transcripts. Actually, what we actually say is very much highly edited.
Absolutely.
Before it comes in a book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't speak like it.
If it's not highly edited, it's unreadable.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and the title, Drink Tea, Eat Cake?
Yes. Where did that come from?
Yeah.
It's my version of a wonderful and extremely well-known Zen proverb, before enlightenment, cut wood, draw water. Mm. After enlightenment, cut wood, draw water. I'm an incredibly lazy person. I used to cut wood long ago. Not only did I cut wood, but the stove for which I cut the wood was on the third story of an old house. So I cut wood and then I carried sacks of the wood up to the third story where my stove was. Oh. So I have paid my dues where cutting wood is concerned. But I am essentially quite lazy now, so I just came up with my own version of that Zen proverb for lazy people, which is before enlightenment, drink tea, eat cake. After enlightenment, drink tea, eat cake. I mean, the meaning is the same. Essentially, what we call, rather foolishly maybe, what we call enlightenment, in a sense, makes no difference. And the beauty of that Zen proverb is it strips out of that concept of enlightenment all the magical superstition that the human mind has a tendency to add to it.
Yeah, so, oh no, I will float in a bunch of light and I will be one with the universe and stuff like that.
Possibly more likely, I will be one with a number of very, very beautiful blonde women. Or whatever it may be, I will be one with a Ferrari. I will have magical powers, I will be able to read minds and people will bow down and kiss my feet. Of course, people, in order to get people to bow down and kiss our feet, we don't need to be enlightened. That's perfectly obvious. All we need to do is pretend to be enlightened.
Yeah, oh my god. Yeah, I like that title. It's if your version of what actually is when dropping off the self occurred and then still drink tea, eat cake, and it's actually that is what is seen as special and not mundane anymore.
I like the title myself, but I have to say that it may be commercially an absolute disaster because, of course, it gives no hint whatsoever
of
what the tin does. It really is a very good example of it does not tell you, what the tin does.
Okay. Well, I have to say that one thing I enjoy most of your books and talking with you is your humor. I love your humor. And I think it adds a great deal of just enjoyment to reading your stuff or talking to you or listening to you talking about non-duality. And I think it's actually also a very beautiful part of the expression of life, humor.
No, I agree, yeah.
Now, 2016, and your latest book came out. Yet now you can.
Now I can show it to the camera.
To show it,
I brought it all the way from London to Berlin to show it. I think it's rather beautiful. I had nothing to do with the design of the cover, obviously, so I am allowed to say I think it's rather beautiful.
Oh yeah, it looks a little bit like it reminds me of light and dark, like of yin and yang a little bit, and it has a very beautiful picture of a beautiful landscape,
yeah,
which you see very often on spiritual websites and stuff. I like it.
I love it. Yeah,
it's
pretty
nice.
I think they've done very well there.
Exploring spirituality and existence in the modern world.
Now, I do have to say, of course, that the kind of blurb you get on the front and back cover of books has nothing to do with anything the author wrote.
Okay.
So don't ask me to explain that subtitle.
Okay. No, I won't. It's pretty thick also.
It's enormous, absolutely. Yes, it's absolutely very large, very long indeed.
Well, so How did this book came into existence as far as the story goes?
Well, I have to say this is another example of extremely lazy writing. For many years, I suppose because I put myself out there for this in that I write books about non-duality, I give talks about it. So for many years, people would email me with questions. Mm-hmm. And for many years, I answered them. I don't do that anymore. I don't have the time to do that anymore. But for many years, I did. And basically, what this book consists of is a collection of some of those many emails and the answers that I wrote to them. So again, in a way, it was a huge editing job.
Stop right there. I want to know, I'm curious about it. Why can't you answer questions via email anymore?
What a very, very embarrassing question, because I use the term, I say I can't answer me, but what I really mean is I won't. Okay. It takes up a lot of time.
You've got even more lazy.
I've got even more lazy. I have other things to do. After a period of some years, I felt that I'd answered pretty much every possible question there was to answer at least three or four times. So I thought, well, that's enough. I've done my bit. I've paid my dues. I'm not doing this anymore. But I have to say that during the years that I was doing it, I enjoyed it very much. It wasn't in a way it was work, but it wasn't work. I had a lot of interesting questions. I communicated with a lot of interesting people, and I enjoyed doing it.
So you just...
It's just time, time moves on.
You just love to write about this issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Since it's a very beautiful issue, it's always fresh.
Yeah.
It's always, it's not never the same with the kind of person that writes to you with a special problem, maybe. And maybe questions come up where you didn't think of even.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I enjoyed writing all of these books very much, but at the same time, I feel I've now written four books on non-duality, and I feel that is enough for anybody.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons this new book is so long is because I was determined to put into it everything I could possibly want to say about non-duality. I didn't want to finish it and have it published and then go, oh hell, I wish I'd said such and such, and then find that I'd have to write another book. So obviously nothing's definite, but what I would say to myself and others is that this is almost certainly my last book about non-duality. There almost certainly will not be another. And it's possible that some people watching this interview may breathe a sigh of relief when they hear that.
Well,
the next book.
It's not a small book, so.
It's not a small book. And my next book is the first one that is not about non-duality.
That book I will also ask a question about, but I think actually that will be one of the last questions ask today, because it's an upcoming project. And so, how came the title? How came the title to you? Non-duality questions, non-duality answers.
Well, I'd already written three books with titles that actually didn't give much of a clue to what was between the covers. And actually, non-duality questions, non-duality answers was going to be the subtitle of this book. And one morning I went to a coffee bar and settled down for the hard job of coming up with an original title to it. And I sort of sat there and started thinking very hard, thinking that it would probably take me an hour or two. And then suddenly, after a very, very short time, I suddenly realised that the subtitle that I thought it would actually make a perfectly good title. And unlike my other books, it would actually do what it said on the tin. So I just had this enormous sense of relief that instead of sitting there working hard for an hour, I could sit there, drink my coffee and stare out of the window at the passers-by. So non-duality questions, non-duality answers is what it became.
Yeah, so at first it was a subtitle, you say?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well,
I think I just got into the habit of thinking that my books needed a smart-ass title and people might be disappointed if I didn't come up with one, and then I thought, oh hell, who cares?
Yeah, well, it's pretty clear, to the core, to the point, and yeah, I think it works perfectly, especially for a book which is all about non-duality questions and answers.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. I know somebody who used to be a bookseller who has solemnly told me that it's a terrible title and that nobody will buy it, but I don't believe him.
Yeah, I think it will work fine. You just said you usually write your books in at a coffee store?
Yeah.
Coffee
bar.
Coffee bar? It's like this is like a normal coffee we also have here in Germany, which we call café.
Yeah.
And
I choose coffee bars. We have these coffee bars in England that have big, comfortable leather armchairs and leather settees, and those are the kind I choose to go to.
And you have your laptop with you and you write your book
there?
Yeah,
a laptop or an iPad or something I write on there, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, it's a nice way to write. You can have a nice coffee or a cup of tea and you write your book and you can relax.
It's also actually quite an expensive way to write, but never mind.
Oh, of course, because you also have to order stuff to be able to sit there all the time. But I read that also J.K. Rowling writes her stuff in coffee shops. So
I think she wrote her first book in a cafe, yes, because some story, she was so poor she couldn't even afford to heat a room in her flat or something like that, so she wrote in a cafe for warmth.
She still likes to write in cafes because she said that's just her favourite kind of way. She can't think of another way.
I think there's something about getting out of your own den, getting out of your own burrow and getting outside where you kind of see people and so forth. It does feel healthy to me to walk down into the town, and actually it is healthy because I live in a town which is composed entirely of hills, so if I walk down to the coffee shop I also have to walk back up again.
Yeah, sounds beautiful, and also saying sounds kind of inspiring.
I think there is something about it. A lot of people feel the same. It kind of loosens things up on a sort of mental level to get out of the house and have a walk and so forth. Yeah, not to mention the invigorating effects of caffeine, which is the is actually the only recreational drug I still take.
Hey, okay, super. Because I wanted to ask you a few questions that also occur in your book to give the readers a taste, live taste of your answers. So, you just mentioned drugs, which is perfect because one of my next questions is about drugs, and I just take this question now and I ask you that you also talk about drugs like LSD in your book.
Yeah.
So, what is your experience with them? I don't know if you're allowed to say, but
If I could sum it up in one word, I would say interesting. Uh-huh. Or two words, extremely interesting. I mean, I took LSD a long time ago. The first time that I took LSD, it did have I'll use the word remarkable effect on me. And in fact, I mean, I won't go into it here. It's not that relevant or indeed necessarily that interesting to what we're talking about. But actually, I do have a long chapter about that in my new book, which hasn't been published yet. So the first time I took it, it really had a kind of the phrase earth shattering is a bit pompous, but kind of in that ballpark. It had a sort of earth-shattering effect on my outlook on life. And then after that it never really had that same kind of impact on me again. After that, it was just a sort of an interesting experience, yeah.
But there was no dropping away of the person?
Absolutely not, no. I had experiences, and that word is important, which at the time I would have considered to be to do with the loss of self, both in meditation and using another drug, which was basically Thai magic mushrooms. But at the time, I would have thought those were experiences to do with what we're talking about here, to do with non-duality. But of course, now looking back, I know that they were not.
Hmm. some drugs are told to be consciousness expanding or mind expanding.
Yeah.
Indeed, some drug users say they saw that everything is one. What can you say about that?
Not a lot, because I don't have a great deal of experience. I would certainly say, obviously, drugs can be experience expanding in the sense that they can give us access to a range of experiences that we would not have without those drugs. And then I would simply add to that, that good old English phrase, well, so what? So we expand our experiences. Well, it's still a person who is having those experiences, so it doesn't have anything to do with it doesn't have anything to do with what we're talking about here. When it comes to drugs where people claim that it has produced the dropping away of the self, what I would say to that, I'm cautious to talking about that because I haven't had that experience, but I have talked to a few people who have, and the thing that I seem to notice in talking to these people is that that does not seem to bring about the total transformation of the person who is left afterwards that the natural arising of liberation has. That's really all I can say. So it doesn't seem to me that we are necessarily talking about things which are in exactly the same ballpark. But I'm not that qualified to talk about it or to make a definitive judgment. And essentially, it doesn't really matter, because if somebody is drawn to taking drugs, they will probably take drugs, and if they're not, they won't. I would add, and neither of those will have any relevance at all as to whether the final seeing of liberation occurs, because the seeing of liberation is acausal, it's not caused by anything.
Okay, but then we come to the next question, because you say it is not caused by anything, but just from what you think, do you think there's a chance of a substance being developed that can alter the brain in a way that one is a scene, or that can drop the experience of being a person? Because if so, that could indeed become a popular product one day.
Yes. Or, an adjunct to that question, rather than a drug, maybe a neuroscientist fiddling around with some electrical stimulation of some part of the brain. It seems to me that that would be maybe as likely or more likely. I mean, one thing I do know is that there are certain neuroscientists who would say that they can reliably induce out-of-the-body experiences in people by electrical stimulation of a certain part of the brain. Now, an out-of-the-body experience has nothing to do with what we're talking about here, but if electrical stimulation of the brain can produce that, is it possible that it could produce the dropping away of the self? I don't know. It's possible.
So you don't think it is? Do you think it is absolutely impossible, since it is not caused by anything, or do you think that the kind of the way the brain is actually altered, it might be possible?
Hypothetically, I think I can give a very, very confident and resounding, I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know. I would say, many, many questions are very definitely in the land of the unknowable. This is one which I would say, well, it's in the land of the unknown. Maybe it's unknowable, or maybe it's simply unknown. Who knows? Who knows?
Okay. And by the way, I'm not saying anybody should take drugs or go to somebody who's playing around with electricity with you, so please don't do that. but it's just, I'm just curious, what is the difference of... I already asked that question, sorry. What would you tell someone you like that has this non-dual sense of existence and gets in conflict with friends and family about this? Because they might call them nuts and diverge from them.
Yes, I've had a lot of questions from people and discussions with people exactly around that, people who got into quite deep trouble, we might say, with their friends and family. What would I say? I would say try to say as little about this as possible. Some people, for example, when there is some non-dual realization, let's call it, feel a very strong impulse to talk about it to family and friends in a way which is perhaps not particularly tactful. And maybe if it's possible to, it might be a good idea to resist that impulse. I would just say be careful who you talk to about this. It's not surprising that some people can hear communications about this as highly provocative. They can get very angry about it. They can also get very concerned about, you know, if you were to talk or if I were to talk to somebody we know about this, they could become very concerned. Some people can mistake what is said about this for signs of psychosis, for example. So entirely with our best interests in heart, they might start consulting a psychiatrist or suggesting that we consult a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So all I would say is just sort of natural, you know, be careful who you talk to about this. And if you have a very, very strong impulse to talk to people about this almost in an evangelical way, which some people do, then it's probably a good idea to take a few deep breaths and count to 10 and then maybe go for a walk around the park instead.
So there were some people telling you, I really want to talk about this, I just can't close my mouth. And
well, that's different. Oh, I really want to talk about it. Well, just be careful and try to be kind, really. Try to be kind to the people that you know, because talking about this can be very, you know, it can be very shocking. It strikes, I mean, you know, let's not pussy around about this. I mean, this communication strikes absolutely at the deepest heart of what most people feel their lives are about. And they may not have thought about it consciously, but nevertheless, they will recognise, you know, in the suggestion that there's nobody in there and there's nobody in here, nobody making choices, nobody making decisions, nobody who owns responsibility, nobody who owns morality, nobody who owns virtue.
No.
You know, they may not think about any of that consciously, but nevertheless, a lot of people will hear that suggestion as deeply threatening to their sense of who they are, and they are, it's not a surprise therefore if they become very, very defensive. So it's probably a good idea only to talk about this to people who are genuinely interested in it and genuinely open to it. I mean, I had a conversation the other about 4 or 5 evenings ago in the pub with a friend of a friend who knows nothing about this and was questioning me about it. And I could tell very easily from the kind of questions he was asking that he was genuinely interested. He was open-minded. He wasn't going to become angry or feel threatened by it. So we had a conversation about it. So that's all I'd say.
That's not usual.
No. Probably the
you know, I had conversations about this with seemingly open people, and then after that they were seemingly not interested in talking with me anymore.
Well, probably the people to be most cautious about talking about this to are the people whose kind of outlook on life seems to be maybe very close to what non-duality is saying. So, for example, I mean, I would be very, very wary, for example, about talking about this to quite a lot of Buddhists. I mean, some Buddhists are fine and very open to this, but a lot of Buddhists are not, because Buddhism is kind of, you know, quite close to this. It's a philosophy of no self, after all. But it is a philosophy, and what I'm talking about isn't a philosophy. And although Buddhism is quite close to this, it has some very, very strong differences as well. And Freud has a wonderful phrase that sums up why we often have the most trouble when we're talking to people who almost believe the same as us, but not quite. And Freud used this phrase, the narcissism of small differences. So in other words, if we're talking to somebody who is almost aligned with us, but not quite, they are likely, possibly, not always, but it's quite possible that they may become much angrier and fight us much more strongly than somebody whose view on life is miles and miles and miles away from us. Because the person who has a totally different view of life from us may not feel threatened by what we're seeing. They might just see us as a sort of an eccentric madman whose views can be safely ignored, whereas somebody who's quite close to us is likely to feel much, much more threatened. And this is why, for example, in religions, you know, you get the worst violence, not between one religion and another religion, you get the worst violence between two different sects within the same religion. Mm. Because the fact that they're so close to each other makes them hate each other even more over their differences. So, you know, if I give an example of that, you know, the bloodiest Christian crusade was not against Islam, which is quite a long way away from Christianity. It was against Catholic heretics. It was against the Cathars, the Albigensians. So the bloodiest, or if you like also, it was the Catholics against the Protestants and the Protestants against the Catholics. So the bloodiest wars in Christianity were not against members of other religions. They were against members of the same religion who believed something slightly different about the nature of the Holy Trinity, for example.
Well, when it comes to non-duality, isn't it possible that if there are still some differences where some two people seem to be saying the same, yeah, and there's no one, there's just this and stuff like that, but still some views, some kind of opinions or whatever seem to differ, that you could just say, well, each apparent person is presented slightly differently, like no two snowflakes are the same, so we don't have to be exactly the same. So maybe just okay and just have a cup of tea and...
Absolutely, in principle. And there are, of course, lots of differences in the way different people talk about non-duality. And in principle, you know, it's lovely to sit down and have a cup of tea and a piece of cake. But the human personality is the human personality, the human psyche is the human psyche, and Freud's wonderful rule about the narcissism of small differences also kicks in. So it's quite likely that two people who have slightly different views about non-duality may fight far more fiercely about that than a Christian might fight with a Sikh, for example. I mean, all I would say to that is, well, none of it matters, and if you can avoid it, it's probably better to just go and sit by the lake on a bench and look at an oak tree.
Yeah, no view is ultimately correct or 100% it.
But as soon as we describe the indescribable, we're onto a we're onto a losing game, aren't we? Yeah. Again, we're going back to Alan Watts, who talked about trying to F the ineffable. But nevertheless, it's kind of interesting and entertaining and amusing sometimes to try. So I know that when I talk or write about non-duality, I am embarking on a hopeless task, but I enjoy doing it anyway.
You can't put in words what this is. It's impossible.
I mean, if you think about it, if we take some really simple phenomenon like the taste of a lemon, you can't describe that in words.
Yes, of course. Actually, many of our words don't help much at all to describe even feelings, you know. Love is such a general word, but it is used for so many different tastes of feelings and so on. Yeah, so have you ever had the experience, so to speak, that you had that you talked about non-duality with another non-duality speaker or whatever, and there were a few slight differences, but there wasn't a fight over it?
Oh yes, of course. Yeah,
so then it was like, oh, I don't know if I agree with that, but oh, whatever.
Yeah. Oh, I don't. Yeah, I don't particularly want to have fights with,
of course,
other people. I mean, the most extreme one, however, and I mean, this was not this was not a slight difference, really. And this is also in the new book that I'm writing at the moment. I did have a conversation with another non-duality speaker over tea at one point. It was going very, very well. We were getting along fine. And then he said something, and I suddenly realised he lived in a world which was dominated by David Icke's shape-shifting giant bejewelled lizards. Yeah. And well, I love the look on your face. It's a pity the camera isn't pointing at you right now. Yes, exactly. Eh? What? What is that about? At that point, I realised that he and I live in totally different universes, and there really was no point in continuing this conversation. But we didn't have an argument about it. I just kind of withdrew and thought, this is not somebody I want to talk to anymore.
Can you... have you any metaphor or any picture what how to explain the difference, the seemingly same thing but then the totally difference?
Sorry, I didn't understand that question.
It seems to be that you were seemingly talking about the same thing,
non-duality,
but then in the end it was different on a great differed greatly.
Yeah, he suddenly introduced basically a vast paranoid conspiracy theory into the conversation, and to me that kind of doesn't sort of match. I think, well, how can non-duality have been seen and yet somehow your mind is still prey to this absurd and highly toxic paranoid conspiracy theory? But that was my response.
You mean such kind of a theory like aliens are controlling us,
yeah,
or something
exactly,
like that?
Exactly that, yeah.
Well, even if that would be the case, the aliens would still be this.
So, yeah, exactly, yeah, who cares? Yeah.
It all falls apart. You know?
Yeah. If I am confronted by somebody who seriously believes that the world is controlled by giant alien
lizards... I was
lizards,
confronted.
My response to that tends to be, you know, well, to be honest, I don't really care. You know, if it's not me that's controlling the world, why should I care who it is? Why should I care whether it's, you know, why should I care whether it's the industrial military complex or giant alien lizards?
What,
it doesn't make any difference
change?
To me.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I would prefer not to have to talk to people over tea about this sort of nonsense.
It does sound like a thrilling movie, though.
Maybe, Maybe. Perhaps I'll write the film script one day.
That would be interesting. I actually come back to that later.
Okay.
So where are we? What effects can liberation have for the personal dream, the dream of being a person? Can it have any effects at all?
Yes, it
can. Positive or negative? I think both, maybe
both.
Even.
It's both possible,
really?
Absolutely.
Everybody wants this and thinks only bliss comes.
Well, the problem is, you know, everybody, lots of people want this, but they can have no idea whatsoever of what this is.
Yeah.
So this is simply... some imagined scenario which has nothing to do with the reality if this actually occurs. What was the original question?
What effects can liberation have for the waking dream?
So the first very important thing to say is there are absolutely no rules. So anything can happen. So anything that I say about this can only be considered to be tendencies of what might happen. But there is, I would say, certainly a tendency for neurosis to decrease. Neurosis tends to make life very difficult. So from that point of view, there is certainly a tendency for life to become easier, at least in that psychological sense.
Do you have another word for neurosis for people who don't know what that word means?
Yes, irrational fears, irrational anxieties, irrational angers, irrational sadness. Of a habitual nature, of a kind that keeps occurring and reoccurring and reoccurring, really regardless of what is going on in my actual life. So, for example, if I'm intensely neurotic, those feelings can destroy and sabotage any possibility of happiness, because if something really good is happening in my outer experience, I'm not capable of enjoying that really good thing because there'll be so much anxiety or misery or anger floating around in my internal headspace. That's a I think that'll do as a kind of description of neurosis, yeah. So there's a strong tendency for neurosis to reduce, although that doesn't have to be the case. There is a strong tendency for certain feelings not to be experienced anymore. And I would say there is a strong tendency for depression to disappear. There's a strong tendency for boredom to disappear. There's a strong tendency for nostalgia or other feelings which hang around past experience to disappear. These are only tendencies, but that is what often happens. Also,
I would say to 90s parties, it's just fun.
I would also say there is a strong tendency for feelings, including uncomfortable feelings, to become stronger and to be more raw. The feeling may be less neurotic and less long-lived, but it may be stronger and more raw.
I think you, with nostalgia, you meant, everything was better back then.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the good old times.
Exactly.
While when the times were, it was like, life is...
Exactly.
It's not good.
Yeah. So any kind of feeling which tends to accrete around a yearning for the past tends to disappear.
Yeah.
It tends to disappear.
Like then it was better.
Feelings around a tendency to dwell about the future also tend to lessen or disappear. So there's simply much more attention for what actually is appearing now, for the phenomena that are actually appearing now.
It gets much richer.
Yeah.
It becomes apparent that it is already rich, that it always was rich.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that tree, which is outside your window, which the camera can't see but which I can see, is a much richer tree because the attention that's on it is not being drawn to events that apparently happened in the past or events that might happen in the future with all the attendant emotions that attach to those events. Yeah.
Well, does that mean do you experience the waking dream more intensely now, thanks to liberation? Is that what you were trying to say?
I suppose we could put it like that. I'm slightly resistant to the word intense, because for me it has a very emotional feel to it, but it will do. What I would say is there's simply a much more natural focus on presence, on what is actually happening, rather than ruminations about the past, ruminations about the future, imaginings about the future, nostalgic feelings about the past. So there's just a much more natural kind of being in this, if you like. Obviously, the spiritual paths are full of and redolent with suggestions for following techniques which are designed to produce a kind of more full, if you like, and rich contact with what is actually happening right now. And I would say that those are kind of our ersatz or artificial ways of trying to produce what naturally happens if liberation is seen.
I do remember that I did a few of, I don't know the English word, Achtsamkeit training, where you're more focused more on what is right now, you see?
There are lots
and
of
it,
such
it,
things.
It did occur that for a short amount of time, I was able to eat more slowly and taste more and stuff, but it didn't take long until the focus was more on past and future again.
I'd say two things about, and there's so many of these techniques, I would say two things about them. One is, as you said, they don't last very long. And then the second thing I would say is that if the sense of self does actually drop away, and then there's just this, it's realised that that presence, let me call it artificial presence, I'm really tasting this spoonful of soup or whatever, invoked by those techniques has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. Nothing at all to do with it. They're not in the same.
Yeah, yeah.
Ballpark.
It's more in other words,
me intentionally being present has nothing to do with presence.
Yeah. Because me is also present itself.
Yeah. I mean, having said that, it's possible that these exercises and practices may have some therapeutic benefit. I mean, for example, the best known of these practices is Buddhist mindfulness. It's possible that might have some therapeutic benefit, but it has nothing to do with what we're talking about.
I wouldn't put them down. They've proven to be quite well for, you know, people who try to stop drinking alcohol and stuff.
Sure.
A few people for the first time got a more taste that life is more than just their head.
Sure, absolutely.
No,
So therapeutically they may well be beneficial, but it's not what we're talking about.
But it does look a little bit weird now that people talk about I want to live in the moment.
As if there was anywhere else.
Because it's ridiculous.
Yeah, but we know what people mean by that. What people really mean by that is they want to be less in their heads, and that can have a therapeutic benefit.
Yeah. Well, what about relationships? Can relationships improve or not?
Mm.
Because I think if it's obvious that all there is presence, let's call it that, it might be a little bit different what kind of relationship, how you live relationships. I don't know how to say that. Do you think that it can alter the way you are as a person in a relationship?
Definitely. And again, there are no rules, so relationships can improve, or they can deteriorate, or they can break up. And they can deteriorate or break up particularly, for example, in circumstances where one of the things that held the relationship together was a united and combined spiritual path or belief.
Yeah.
And then if one person sees this, that can then blow the relationship apart quite obviously. On the other hand, seeing this is quite likely to substantially reduce neurosis. And neurosis, a high level of neurosis, is very good for messing up relationships. So if neurosis reduces, even if only in one party in the relationship, that can improve the relationship, of course. So there aren't any rules. I would say that, you know, if one partner in a relationship sees this, it's probably quite helpful if the other partner in the relationship also sees this. But as there's nothing that can be done about that, we can't take that as advice.
Yeah.
Maybe one day, I've just had an idea, and maybe we can make a lot of money out of this, and maybe somebody's already done it. Maybe one day there can be a non-duality dating website. This is a brilliant idea, or maybe not. Perhaps it's a really rubbish idea, but bringing together people where this has been seen.
I am no one, you are no one. Let's be no one together. Let's make no sex together.
Okay, look, I'm very lazy, and I know that I am not going to carry through on this proposition. So this is my free gift to you to do this if you want, or anybody who's watching this video. If you want to pick this ball up and run with it, I won't kind of sue you for a share of the profits.
Okay, then good luck with that, guys. But it's not like liberation makes meals taste more intensive or better, or the sex better.
Yes, all of that it may do. Of course, it may do. Well, of course, because if there's a reduction in neurosis and simply more focus on what is happening, whether what is happening is eating a meal or having sex, making love, then of course it may very much make that difference. But for all of these things, whatever I say about that, I have to add the words "or not."
It may not,
because there are no rules.
Yeah, so it's absolutely a mystery what occurs.
It's a complete mystery. Well, everything is a complete mystery, of course.
But it's pretty normal to still have apparent relationships.
Yeah.
Is it also normal, even if you see that it is all a dream, that there are actually no relationships, that still occurs that you say, I love my father, or and you go out, will have a father-son trip, and you feel like a son, even though it is clear this is... What's appearing? It can still appear?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to say, yes, of course it can still appear. I have to say that, you know, by and large, we tend to interpret the world as we ourselves experience it. So I am told there are individuals out there who talk about non-dual. I haven't met any of these, but I am told by other people there are individuals out there who talk about non-duality who say that ultimately there is a non-dual state in which there can be no relationships whatsoever, and that anyone who still has a relationship has not reached that ultimate state. Well, all I can say about that is of course complete baloney, but that is what that individual is experiencing. That individual, for whatever reasons, is experiencing a state in which they don't have relationships. There may be very many psychological quirks that cause that, and because they are experiencing the world in that way, they extrapolate from that, you know, this is how the world is for everybody. So, it's ridiculous and we can ignore it. So
that means they may think this is what true non-duality is. It means no relationship whatsoever anymore. And then they think, just because that is the thing they experience, that thing that comes up, they think it's the same for everyone. So everyone who still has relationships cannot talk about non-duality, of course.
Exactly.
And this is actually like selective experiencing
now. We all like to be special and different, and some of us who are more grandiose than normal like to be the most special and different. So we don't like to feel that there is anybody else as special and different as we are, and so that tends to produce these kinds of completely phony stories about enlightenment, let's say.
Wow, this is really beautiful, because it has such a rich this whole issue of non-duality is, you can ask so many questions, it's beautiful. Some people talk about an indescribable bliss when they saw liberation. Like, it is all just a yes to everything.
Yeah.
So it is not just, oh, everything is empty, it's just life. So it is a yes to everything. It is more than the word love could ever describe. So what can you say about bliss? I think it's what many people hope for. If they hear, oh, he's into bliss, that's what I want.
Yeah.
Eternal bliss.
Yeah, Santa Claus, fear is at the bottom of the garden. I think
go that far.
in terms of like a state of eternal bliss, I mean, all states are evanescent. They're constantly changing. Of course, I think the important word you used was there was indescribable. I mean, the phrase indescribable bliss destroys itself, because if it's indescribable, we cannot use the word bliss, because the word bliss describes something. I would say the seeing of liberation is definitely indescribable. It cannot be put into words. However, if we are, the third time I've used Alan Watts's phrase, if we're going to try to F the ineffable, and why shouldn't we, then the seeing of liberation, I like the phrase unconditional love. I think the reason I like it is because it's not as excitable as bliss. Perhaps, you know, I'm English. I'm maybe therefore not emotionally terribly excitable, I don't know. And bliss seems to me a overblown and pompous word, so I will tend to avoid it. But if somebody else feels that's a better word, that's absolutely fine. But ultimately, all words will fail and must fail, because what is seen in liberation is indescribable. Whether we call it bliss, love, or a giant hedgehog doesn't matter.
Well, the problem with descriptions, they can always only be about form. And about one thing as opposed to another thing.
Yeah. I want to add one other word there, because the word bliss is, I think, sometimes used by gurus and teachers who want to attract followers, and they offer those followers the promise of unending bliss. Now, that is always, without exception, a fraudulent offer, because nothing is unchanging. Everything is constantly changing, including bliss-like states. So it is undoubtedly a fraudulent offer. However, many people have realized that making fraudulent but plausible sounding offers is a very good way to attract followers and a very good way to make money.
Yeah. That's a thing that from what comes up, everything that you could describe or point to is always changing, and it's kind of a hint that life has no form. You can't grasp it.
So if anybody offers anyone, makes a very, very attractive but kind of rather impossible sounding offer and wants money for it, I would be very wary of that.
Yeah, you know, lately I saw a poster here in Berlin. Sometimes gurus were visit Berlin, and they have their large halls, and people go there, pay much money. And then there was a poster with Sri Lama Rama Ding Dong, whatever. And there was a photo of him, and here's the master with his blissful smile that shows practically what you can get if you go there. He was smiling very a little bit slightly, and I was like, okay, well, he will get some money, I'm very sure. Because it really seemed like a fixed state that you might get if you go there, and he's always blissful. Like, wouldn't that be that's just what's coming up right now for me, but wouldn't that be boring if it was always blissful?
I don't know, but I do know that one of the reasons that the common devotees have to be kept well away from the guru during his or her off moments, you know, in other words, relaxing between meetings and so forth, one of the reasons that the devotees must be kept well away from them is because they mustn't see the guru when they're off guard, when they're not pretending to be in this state of eternal bliss. I don't give much advice, but I suppose I'll chance a piece here, and I would say, you know, never follow a guru unless they're happy to go down to the local cafe and have a cup of tea with you, where you might see them off guard and see what they're really like, rather than see them in that wonderful but fake blissful state sitting on their golden throne on top of the platform.
Yeah, I would prefer that too. That's much more.
But basically, I mean, what we do, see, what I mean, the reason that teachers and gurus like that thrive is because we project our yearnings onto them. You know, we reject our own, you know, inner perfection in a way, we have to, and then we project that on a figure out there. And in a sense, you know, the only way, you know, to stop those projections is to sort of, you know, to take them back into ourselves, to realize that it's not out there in somebody else.
Isn't it weird that, I mean, we do experience that everything is changing. We complain about it all the time, like, oh, yeah, my skin isn't what it used to be and stuff.
Yeah.
And the house, it doesn't seem like a house is standing perfectly for 100 years and then it goes down. It always, something changes, and so it's weird that people don't get that whatever they want to get something with a happy end to grasp it, it's just weird to wish for.
Yes, the most obvious fact about existence is mutability, that everything is constantly changing.
Okay, well, I think the mind is just very good at being ignorant. I just wanted to tell that I remember I had a day where I was suddenly in a state of bliss, you could say. Suddenly I was feeling very happy. I don't know what occurred, and the chemical stuff also, so, but I was very, very happy. And the thing is, it didn't stop. It went on for hours and hours. I had this, this happy feeling for hours. And it didn't stop. And at first it was beautiful, but hours went by and it didn't stop. And I reached a point where I wanted to stop. Because right. it was like first off the taste of a beautiful cake, and at one time it was like somebody was just I was just tied to a chair, and somebody was constantly feeding me with my favorite cake, and I was like, enough, it's okay, and then it went down, and I was really happy, and I was really that really made me see what it would be if you had constant bliss, and it was not nice. It was not what people actually want. And that, I feel really happy that this occurred. Because I don't, that really stopped that wish.
I would say liberation is very ordinary.
The ordinary is the extraordinary. That's the biggest surprise. When people ask, does anything matter? You usually state that it doesn't, but you also say what appears may matter greatly in the waking dream. So then, does that also count when liberation is has occurred? Can things, personal situations still apparently matter?
I mean, I don't know whether it helps if we substitute the phrase things matter for there are preferences. So on a, as long as the psychophysical organism is still alive, there will almost certainly be preferences. So in that way, all sorts of things may matter. You know, it may matter whether I, you know, get to the theatre and into my seat before the performance starts. You know, that may matter. It may matter whether I have my favourite marmalade or not. Who knows? It may matter whether I get a cup of coffee rather than a cup of tea. So on that level, of course, there are preferences. When I say nothing matters or nothing has any meaning, you know, I mean in a kind of ultimate sense. We love, you know, we are meaning-creating animals. We love to make up meanings for everything, for the universe, for myself, for my life, for the fact that some wonderful synchronicity happened a week ago or something like that. So it's on that level, of course, that all of those meanings are simply stories that we've made up. On that level, nothing has any meaning and nothing matters. It doesn't need to. Everything is simply full as it is. Again, I'm referring to the tree outside your window, which the camera can't see, but is rather beautiful. You know, that tree doesn't need to have a meaning to be a perfectly satisfactory tree, and you and I don't need to have a meaning to be perfectly satisfactory human beings.
I feel very happy that just where my computer is, there's a window, and I can always see how the tree moves, because I love that. It reminds me of an ocean moving waves. I love that.
I'd also add, you know, that meaning on that kind of metaphysical level, going back to presence, meaning also is remarkably effective at taking us away from presence, at taking us away from what is. Because if I have a head full of stories about meaning, that what really matters in, let's say that I might have the story that what really matters in this situation here where you're interviewing me is that I should somehow find a way of converting you to a belief in Christ, which, you know, is perfectly possible, you know, if I was a member of some mad sect or even not a mad sect, right? Now, if that was my purpose here, you know, in kind of fulfilling this higher meaning, that is going to be taking my attention all the time away from the reality of what is.
So the we have to save the world and sacrifice so the moment.
The sense of metaphysical meaning takes us up into the higher stratospheres of our mind, our intellect, our head, whatever you want to say, and it drains the present moment, or it drains presence of its life and energy.
Well, it seems that life likes to play that too, so...
Life likes to play that too, obviously.
It seems to be perfectly fine with that. So, because of course, even those people are still alive, just appearing as whatever.
So there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing right with it. It is simply what's happening.
Yeah. I was once like, what is right, what is wrong? And I think the most beautiful thing was the solution was, there is no solution.
Of course, right and wrong are constructs of the human mind.
Yeah, totally. Well, and so it can also matter, like, for example, when somebody dies, it could totally be that you yearn, that you are sad.
Of course.
Not that you... It's not for every so-called liberated person that he says, oh, there's nobody there, there was never anybody there, so whatever.
Of course. Of course. I quote in one of my books, I can't remember which one, I believe it might have been a Korean Zen master who said, nobody knows sorrow like a Zen master.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure why Zen masters particularly should be singled out, but the point is that what he is saying is that this doesn't give you access to some sort of special state where nothing touches you emotionally. That's ridiculous. The people who are in a... I hope the camera can see my inverted comma signs,
yes,
there.
Yes.
I don't know. People who do seem to be in this special state where they are unaffected by life events may simply be very cut off people emotionally anyway.
Hmm. Yeah, and even if there are actually some people who are very little concerned ever, that's what's life presenting them as.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why not that too?
Yeah.
But of course people will run to them if they are teachers. So
they may well do, particularly if they're suffering a lot and they want to find a way out of their suffering.
Yeah. Okay. Now we were talking about death, so I have a question about death, about the fear of death.
Right.
Is it... So, I think I already know your answer, but I will ask you anyway. Can it still appear that fear of death can come up, even though it is clear that nobody is dying? That maybe when the time has come, so to speak, still it could come up that, no, I don't want to die or so? Could that still appear, or is that impossible?
I'd say three things about that, I think. Firstly, I always make a clear distinction between the fear of death and the fear of dying. They have nothing to do with each other. The fear of dying is the fear of a certain event which takes place in our life, mm-hmm. and may take place in a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Death is not an event which takes place in a person's life.
Yes, okay, sorry, then I mean the fear of dying.
The fear of dying may well continue. The fear of death is likely to end. Again, I have to stress there are no rules, but the fear of death is likely to end when liberation is seen. The fear of dying may continue. However, I've already said there's likely to be less neurosis. Some of the fear of dying may be neurotic, so to that extent it may decrease.
Well, would you say to someone, if someone said, Richard, it was clearly seen there is no one, but lately I had problems breathing and I really was afraid of dying. I mean... That can't be. How can that be?
Of course it can be. Because there's still a psychophysical organism there. It's very, very natural, even on the most basic evolutionary level, that psychophysical organism wants to avoid discomfort, wants to survive. That's what we are evolutionarily programmed to do. So there is no reason at all why that person might not be, considerably upset by, let's say, the fear of a very uncomfortable form of dying.
Yeah.
However, having said that, to whatever extent that is neurotically based, is likely to reduce. So even the fear of dying is likely to... The fear of dying is really, by the way, it's not a fear of dying, it's the fear of the way of dying or the process of dying, the way in which that process takes place. Possibly the pain and so forth, who knows what might happen. And so even that is likely to reduce as neurosis reduces. The fear of death is likely to disappear.
Okay, so it's more likely to come up then when it's time than even when you're just sitting there and have a nice cup of tea. So, yeah, of course. Yeah, okay, well. Let's see in the next slide. Can you talk about hope in general? I want you, what do you have to say about the issue?
Hope. What I usually say about hope is one of the cruelest feelings. And despair, nothing is close to what we're talking about here. But if anything were to be close to it, despair is closer to what we're talking about than hope. I mean, hope.
Or hopelessness.
Or hopelessness, yeah. Hopelessness and despair. Hope keeps us searching. Hope is a very, very cruel taskmaster because it drives us on. Hope won't take us, let us take any rest. You know, I mean, hope is very cruel indeed. You know, I'm sitting relaxing in a chair having a cup of tea and hope says to me, you lazy person, you know, you should be up on your feet. You should, you know, if you were just seeking or striving with a little bit more sincerity, if you got up earlier and you just went to visit your master more often and listen to his holy words with more attention, then that's what would get you to this wonderful state called enlightenment. So hope is very, very cruel indeed. In a way, hope simply arises or it doesn't. Despair simply arises or it doesn't. And there is no one who can do anything about that. So what I am about to say next is in a sense futile, but nevertheless I'll say it. Despair is closer to this than hope is. There are no good signs, but if there were to be a good sign, despair would be a good sign. And as a matter of fact, I talk to many, many people, and often where there's been awakening or where there's been liberation, that has been preceded by a period of despair. That's by no means always the case, but it's the case often enough to make it worth commenting on.
Do you have anything good to say about hope? Can it also be good sometimes?
Well, yes.
Because some people who were imprisoned by the Nazis said the thing that kept despair away actually was a feeling of hope.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I'd say two things. First, it can be very entertaining. It can provide us with a lot of very entertaining and stimulating circumstances. And secondly, in terms of what you're talking about, you could say that in certain circumstances, hope can be therapeutically beneficial.
So it can have positive
effects. Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. But in terms of what we're talking about here, I mean, I'm not saying that despair is better than hope. I'm just saying that despair is closer to what we're talking about here than hope is.
Totally. It's just that so many movies glorify hope. In the end, the answer is hope.
Of course.
Sometimes even as the main reason to stay alive.
Yeah.
Like, oh, what is this all about? What is life? And then, oh, you know, there's always hope.
Yeah, now there's another thing to put
it
in.
It seems a very popular reason to keep going to something.
There's another thing to put in here. Notice also that hope is always orientated towards the future.
Yes.
So hope, again, it's one of those experiences, feelings, thoughts, whatever we want to call it, that always drains this of its life. Because to whatever extent there's hope, I am orientated towards the future. One of the reasons despair is more relaxing than hope, because despair, may not be very pleasant, although it's surprising that a lot of people in a strange way almost enjoy despair, but despair can at least allow me to sink into this. And there may simply be more thisness about despair than there is about hope. Again, I'm not saying that that's better or worse, but it is perhaps one of the things I say is that it is simply more relaxing. Despair is more relaxing than hope.
Just to clarify this, you say that despair can have a positive side to it?
Despair, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, if it, as I've said, it's likely to be more relaxing. It's likely to, you know, we're likely to be more present, because hope, as opposed to despair, orientates us towards the future and away from this.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, in practice, of course, none of this matters, because hope will arise or it will not arise, and despair will arise or it will not arise.
Yeah, even when you talk about the now is drained out, or so, it's still full of life, even if it appears as I look to the, towards the future. It's just
sure,
what
yeah,
life
yeah.
is doing, yeah. doing its thing.
Yeah.
Okay, well, and it can be entertaining, as you said, in movies or so. Many people.
Well, all religions and all the world's spiritual paths are based on hope.
Yeah, yes.
And they're very entertaining, some of them.
I won't start about here, about that here, but it's really interesting to look at spiritual, very spiritual people when it's seen that this is it, you know, because then I entered a Facebook group like spiritual singles. And what they talk about, and it's much about hope and stuff, like bring the world to a better place, or and how can we end the negative thoughts, like really trying to end all the negativity, mm-hmm. and the belief that that is actually possible. And it does sound like a lot of stress.
Yeah,
and the most
very hard work.
The most sad thing about this, I would say, is that I can totally see that what the belief itself is bringing all the stress, not the world.
Yeah.
The world is not that bad.
Yeah.
Saving
the world.
People think about it.
Yeah. Saving the world in any way whatsoever is by and large extremely hard work.
Yeah. I mean, okay, on the other side, you said that even after liberation, the body wants to have pleasant feelings, maybe
yeah.
sometimes a therapy or so, if it is needful.
Possibly.
For getting rid of drugs or so might be a good idea.
Possibly.
So as a world place, this earth thing, it's not a total bad idea maybe to I mean, I think it's not a completely ridiculous idea to behave in a way that maybe is more beneficial for the planet than behaving in a way that you just pollute everything or so.
Sure.
So I mean, it is all apparent, but it does make sense in a way, you know.
Makes perfect sense.
It's just if you think that is, if you dedicate your whole life to that and only to that maybe future that may come one day, then it's just not seeing what actually is.
Well, there's
how
nothing,
could it be?
There's nothing wrong with being an eco-warrior.
Yeah.
There's nothing right with it either. It
yeah.
is simply what it is.
It's simply what it is. That's true. Mm. Okay, can you maybe talk about depression? Is there something you can say about people who are very depressed, who find themselves in a depressed state? I don't know if despair and depression is quite the same. Always.
Oh no, they're very different. They're not even a little bit different. They're very different.
I'm sorry if you have nothing to say about this, then it's not important. I was.
I'll try and. I think I possibly have one or two things I could say about depression. Very, very briefly, I'll say one thing. The therapist in me will say one thing, which is that my experience as a therapist has led me to feel very strongly that the most therapeutic way of dealing with our feelings is to allow ourselves to experience them, not to cut ourselves off from them either simply emotionally or through drugs or alcohol or ceaseless activity or something like that. There's a phrase for this common amongst psychotherapists. It's called experiential non-avoidance. So if we're experiencing some feeling, even if it's unpleasant, the most therapeutic thing to do with that is to allow ourselves to experience it. Mm-hmm. I feel, and some psychotherapists will agree with me and some won't, that depression is the result of a long period of refusing to do that. So depression is the result of a long period of us not allowing ourselves to experience our uncomfortable feelings. So from the therapist in me would say, if you want to avoid depression, then be experientially non-avoidant. In other words, let yourself feel your feelings. From a non-duality point of view, all I can say about depression is what I've already said, that there is a tendency for depression to end when liberation is seen.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay, it's just interesting to ask you that because you have the experience as a psychotherapist.
Well, a therapist, yeah.
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 Some teachers talk about your true nature.
Yes.
Dum, dum, dum.
Lovely.
TM. No.
Your authentic self.
Do you like this term and do you agree with it?
No, I don't like it. I'm not sure what there is to agree or not agree with that. It's another story. I mean, you know, we make up vast numbers of stories in order to keep ourselves seeking. So the idea that I have something called my true nature or my authentic self has given me something else to seek. It's another way of filling up the time between birth and death. It's another way of time structuring, as they say in transactional analysis. You know, I don't know what to do with myself, so I know what I'll do with myself. I have this thing called my true nature, I will set out to find it. Or I have this thing, my authentic self, so I will set out to find it. Now, these phrases are not completely empty, but they are largely empty. I mean, the authentic self, for example. I mean, if I feel myself to be so neurotic that I never reveal to other people what I'm really thinking or feeling because I think it might upset them, mm-hmm. You could say that I'm behaving inauthentically. If somehow, maybe through therapy or in some other way, I find the courage to say what I am actually thinking and feeling rather than to dissemble or lie about it, you could say that I am expressing more of my authentic self. Now, in those limited terms, those phrases make sense, but anything more than that, and I think, yeah, they're just something else to keep the search going.
Well, I have here something.
I mean, what I would say is, you know, I don't even have a self, so how could I have a true self? You don't even have a self, so how could you have a true self? You could say your true self is the realization of
selflessness. I said your true nature, I didn't say your true self. So I think it's something else is pointed to with true nature.
Okay, I would say the same thing. I do not even have a nature. I don't possess something called a nature because, you know, I do not exist to possess anything.
Okay.
So if I don't even possess an artificial nature, how can I possess a true nature? Nevertheless, in therapeutic terms, these phrases are not entirely empty. And they may be helpful to somebody in a therapeutic sense.
Okay, well, let me quote the description for a no-body intensive I read, okay? I just wanted to know what you think about this.
Go on.
This intensive offers those with an open mind the opportunity to discover what truly exists and what doesn't. Come travel with, I don't say the name of the teacher, to the essential and to a new understanding of what lies beyond your stories of body and world. Every step is a joyful falling away of false identity as you witness your true nature appear.
Well, it does sound like fairly overblown claims are being made, as they often are, but I don't know. All I could say is that the offer that's being made there may have I really want to stress this word, the offer that's being made there may have therapeutic value, or it may not, or it may have therapeutic value for some people but not for others. Without having done this workshop, I can't know which it is, but if there is value in that offer, it will be on a therapeutic level, and there's nothing wrong with that at all.
Let me throw off the veil, because it is Byron Katie's Nobody Intensive, where she does the work with others.
Yeah. Well,
do you know it?
A little bit, yeah, I know a little bit about it. So what I would say, I would simply repeat exactly what I just said. That may have therapeutic value, or it may not. I've never done a workshop with Byron Katie, so I can't comment on which it is. Or it may have therapeutic value for some people and not for others. But the value in it will be, if there is value in it, it will be on that level. It will be therapeutic. It will not be to do with what we're talking about here.
Yeah, she has this "What would you be without this story?" And people tend to, she's totally okay if people go towards the just thinking about who they would be without thinking my dad should accept me, and it would be usually more accepting person and stuff. But she's more she has the greatest interest in what would we be here now without any thought. That's actually where this came from. She had this insight, and her first book was very much, let me use the phrase, radical non-duality.
Sure.
And that, and out of this, because it was the question, what are you without your thoughts, was alienating people, she altered to who would you be without the story. And she also said she was always a good businesswoman, so she just developed a technique that can have some value, I think, to see that many things we believe are just stories.
Well,
and everything in a way is a projection and stuff, so that does help people. But there are people who become a little bit like work junkies and trying to work everything that that comes up. And
well, two things I would say. I mean, one is, as I've said, that may have value. If it does, it is therapeutic value.
For many people, it does. Yes.
So it's not. I'm not qualified to comment. So it's not. It's not to do with what we're talking about here. The other thing I notice is that the other thing I notice is that several people who appear to be giving talks about non-duality, it seems to me, are engaging with their audiences in what I call therapy light. That's L-I-T-E, as in light beer. They're engaging in therapy light with the audience. If that's what they want to do, that's what they want to do. If it's what the audiences want, it's what the audiences want. And again, it may have value on that level, it may not. I can't really comment. All I can say is it's not what I'm interested in.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say it has nothing to do with what we're talking about, because, and in a way, everything has to do with it.
Well, I think it's confusing. But, I think insofar as it appears to have to do with non-duality, I think it's confusing. That's my own view. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, being confusing is neither better nor worse than being clear about this.
Yeah, okay. I just, the first time I had contact with Advaita was Byron Katie's book, 100 Names for Joy, which comes from Everything is Unconditional Love. And so she has a book where she interweaves the work with kind of also just pointing that there's just this. It's her way of expressing.
Sure, absolutely.
And of course, it's largely, and she appears to know that it's largely a difference between seeing dropping away,
yeah.
And this technique that can help in a way if you don't believe in stressful thoughts anymore.
Yeah, and it's neither right nor wrong, good nor bad, better nor worse, but it's not for me.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's come to your latest project. I want to know what you have in store for us, upcoming books.
Okay, having written 4 books on non-duality and having decided that 4 is enough for anyone to write, so the next book, which is actually almost finished, is a radical departure from that in a way. It's about the 30 years of seeking that took place before non-duality bit or non-duality hit. So its provisional title is Confessions of a Seeker, Adventures in Spirituality, Therapy and Belief.
You're writing kind of a biography of your life story?
Kind of like that. As I say in the introduction...
What does Tony Parsons say to that?
That's going to be interesting. As I say in the introduction to it, this is the book that I never intended to write, 10 or 12 or more years ago. I decided very firmly that writing a kind of spiritual autobiography was something I absolutely never wanted to do, and now I find myself having nearly finished it. What changed? Well, time goes past apparently, and in a way what changed was that I met one or two new people who kind of listened to me recounting some of my adventures to them conversationally and persuaded me that it might be a good idea to put these into a book, because maybe some other people might be interested in some of these stories too. And the fact is, so I sat down in a coffee bar, of course, to start this, not knowing if it would go anywhere. And the fact is, I like writing in coffee bars. And so there we are. A year or two later, it's nearly finished.
Okay, so did you find yourself enjoying writing?
Yes, very much.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I'm shocked.
To be honest, I found it rather in a very kind of daily or quotidian sense of the word liberating. I found it rather liberating after having written about non-duality for so many years. I mean, I really loved writing about non-duality, but nevertheless, I found this rather freeing. Yeah, absolutely. But it's a story. It's many stories. Like everything else, it's a collection of stories without meaning. But obviously it was entertaining for me to live through them. I discovered that by talking about them to one or two people, they found them a little bit entertaining, at least to listen to. So they persuaded me that maybe a few other people might find them entertaining. And we might all be wrong about that. Maybe nobody else will find this entertaining at all. Time will tell.
Oh, I just hope that Tony Parsons won't say, "You are empathizing the story." How can you?
We'll have to see about that. But as I say, I found it fun to write, and we'll see whether anybody finds it fun to read or not.
You have forsaken non-duality. Just kidding. Okay, but I think it is pretty interesting that you wrote down the story of a seeker, how it came to be that you wanted to despair to end.
I should say it's also quite philosophical as well. There's quite a lot of sort of philosophical stuff in it as well, because that's also part of my nature.
Okay.
It's not just a collection of anecdotes.
Is non-duality kind of in that philosophical thoughts a bit?
Not very much. I do mention it occasionally, but I feel like, there are 4 books about non-duality. I don't need to go into it in this
book. So what kind of other philosophy did you put in there?
Oh, that's such a big question. I mean, there's so many things I've been interested in. So there's existentialism is in there, and postmodernism and all. And just kind of philosophical speculation in general that I've been through. And of course, there's lots and lots of philosophical speculation involved with the various spiritual paths that I've been involved with. I mean, I was once involved with a very dedicated guru path. I've been involved with all sorts of Buddhist groups. You know, there's lots of stuff about religion in there. Not all of it complimentary, I have to say. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff in there as well. Hopefully all in a, not all, but hopefully quite a lot of it in a fairly entertaining and light-hearted way, although I have to say some of it is pretty serious.
So you write from the point of view of someone who is still glorifying the idea of being at the guru or so?
No, I'd say that what I do is I try to write from the point of view of the person who was experiencing that at that time, based on memory. So when I'm writing, but also obviously it has to be with the kind. I mean, as I explained in the introduction, if there is an attitude or a stance in the book as a whole, it is the attitude or stance of skepticism to much of the stuff that I'm writing about. So in a sense, you could almost say like there's a dual attitude, because I'm describing the Richard, let's say, of long ago, and it was many, many years ago, who was following a guru with absolutely wide-eyed credulity and love and wow, and this is just so amazing, and we're saving the planet spiritually and so forth. So there's kind of the attitude of the Richard then, but there's obviously also the attitude of the Richard who is writing this now, who has a great deal of skepticism about any kind of extraordinary claims. And I hope that both of those attitudes come through.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, there's a very popular series out right now. It's called Gotham, and it tells the story of Batman before he becomes Batman, and it says to end exactly at the point where Batman first gets into his suit for the very first time, and then the series ends. So, does your book end with just the point before the dropping of the self, or is that included?
That's a bit too kind of narrative, beginning, middle, and end.
Like nobody begins. Just kidding.
That doesn't really fit as a description. And also, I don't know whether I'm just being a bit pessimistic. I feel my chances of getting a big Hollywood deal out of this book are reasonably remote, whereas I think the Batman book might fly in Hollywood better than this one does.
But what I mean is your book, you have a secret story. Is it ending with a meetings with Tony Parsons, or is it?
No, it's not. It's not sequential in that way. It's too complex for that. It's in the set. Well, it's too complex. I mean, you know, it's like it's more. Each chapter is more, takes a theme and then follows it through what might be. It might be for several years or whatever. So it's not really kind of. It's not. Can I just stress something very important, because I think there is a kind of reason for this. I did not call it autobiography of a seeker. I called it Confessions of a Seeker. So it's like a series of me confessing to various incidents that happened in my past. It's not intended to be a chronological autobiography. Maybe that title came to me. Perhaps it's based on the pattern. There's a very, very good book by a man called Stephen Batchelor called Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist. And again, it's not autobiography of a Buddhist atheist. So it's more a kind of... I think the trouble with an autobiography is that it can be very limiting and imprisoning, because you're kind of following a timeline regardless of whether that actually makes sense or is even interesting. You know, I was born in the year such and such, and my first nursemaid was German, and da-da-da-da-da. You know, if you discard the idea of autobiography, then you can get rid of all that boring structural stuff and just go for the stuff which hopefully is actually meaty and interesting. So there's no pretense that it's a kind of chronological going through my life. I think that would be quite boring and dull.
Well, it sounds pretty interesting. That it sounds more like a more artsy approach to telling your seeker story.
Yeah,
that's nice. I look forward to reading that. Do you know when it will come up?
No. I haven't got a publisher yet.
Oh, and the German publisher, you already phoned him up and said
My German publisher, unfortunately, I have lost my dearly beloved contact with my German publisher because he left the publisher. He no longer works there, and so I don't know. I mean, I feel fairly confident that in one way or another it will eventually be published, but I don't have a publisher yet.
Well, okay, looking forward to a new book. I hope you will publish it very soon. maybe next year, who knows. Well, okay, that was all. Thank you for being with us and answering the questions, Richard. Have a great stay in Berlin, and thank you all for watching here Now TV. So, thank you, Richard, for this wonderful interview.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it very much indeed myself.
Me too. I wish you have a great stay.
Thank you.